You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It should come as no surprise to WNYC listeners that Kurt Anderson's latest novel is set among groundbreaking cultural moments and that his characters freely discuss ideas about art, politics, music, and society. Because that's something he does every week on Studio 360, his NPR program. True Believers is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Kurt Anderson back to our show. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
The Supreme Court has been in the news a lot recently, and it figures prominently in the premise of this book. Just a lucky coincidence, I imagine.
I had several lucky coincidences. The main character, Karen Hollander, begins the book as she has just removed herself from contention for an empty seat on the Supreme Court and is now writing this memoir to explain why she had to do that. I had some other lucky coincidences. I finished this book, the first draft of it, last summer, just before Occupy Wall Street. And I had these sort of Occupy Wall Street protests going on, so I had to, part of my revision was giving it a name.
Mm-hmm. It's calling it Occupy Wall Street and just saying, instead of just saying protest, because this deals with the protests of the 60s and then the protests of today. Although you actually have her writing the book in 2013. This isn't exactly speculative fiction.
No, but it gives, setting it a little bit forward, at least gives literalist me the ability to imagine certain things that don't exist now that, as you're reading it as a reader, could say, that could exist. And I flip back and forth between the late 60s and now in order to sort of tell this mystery, to reveal this mystery slowly over the course of the book.
And there have been many books of fiction and nonfiction that have examined the political, social, cultural, sexual changes that occurred in America from the late 60s on. What got you interested in writing about it?
Well, I was alive in the 60s, but I was a little kid who, by the time I got to college and was of an age to take part, it felt like it was over. So I've always felt like I wanted to, in a certain sense, relive it, redigest it. Also, this is a mystery. It's got some humor. I found there are lots of great books about the 60s and great fiction, but it tended, for my taste, to be a little solemn and self-romanticizing, and I wanted to do a different take.
Well, many people have pointed out that 1968 especially, but many of the years of the 60s, but 68 almost seemed to be a turning point in American history. And that's why we call the 70s the 60s.
Well, exactly. I mean, the 70s are when the late 60s sort of scaled up and everybody took part. Absolutely. But it was unquestionably remains this sort of inflection point that we are still living with the consequences of today.
On July 4th, you published an op-ed piece in the New York Times that has inspired quite a few letters to the editor. In it, you wrote that in the late 1960s and over the next two decades, American individualism was fully unleashed. A kind of tacit grand bargain was forged between the counterculture and the establishment, between the forever young and the moneyed, and that permitted people of every age, you say, to indulge their self-expressive and hedonistic impulses, but capitalists in return would be unshackled as well, free to indulge their own animal spirits with fewer and fewer fetters in the forms of regulation, taxes, and social opprobrium. Was that all an afterthought, or did it grow out of the ideas that you were grappling with when you were writing the novel?
It did grow out of the process of writing True Believers. And I was at this, as I say in that piece, I was at this writers' conference upstate in Woodstock, of all places, and somebody said, oh, why have we won all the battles on the cultural side and we're losing all the battles on the economic side, this, you know, lefty person said.
Well, there were people who were talking about a revolution actually occurring and Bob Dylan inspiring a whole generation of people to become leftists or even socialists.
And not
instead,
so much.
He became a conservative.
Yes, and everybody can wear blue jeans, and everybody can listen to rock music, and everybody can do their own thing. So those things happened. But I suddenly realized that it wasn't such a contradiction or incongruous. That what was also unleashed was the ability then in the 80s and 90s and still today for capitalists and investors to do their own thing as well.
Now, I make at least one mistake like the New York Times, in every segment. I said that Studio 360 is an NPR show. It's a PRI show.
It is.
You write in the book that JFK's assassination fostered a heavy weightlessness in the country. What do you mean by that?
That everybody was suddenly and profoundly disturbed by this thing. That, you know, we didn't have yet all the other consequential assassinations. I'm telling it from a child's point of view, and I was an even younger child, that it was this amazing, horrible thing that had happened, but that immediately after that long weekend, unprecedented weekend of constant news coverage, everything went back to normal. And you know, lives weren't ruined, houses weren't flooded out, nothing, it had no immediate consequence, even though it seemed like this gigantic earth-shattering, history-changing moment, which it turned out to be.
Unlike what happened after 9/11. Although it's interesting that both have inspired many conspiracy theories.
And 'twas ever thus, but I do think that's one of the things that the Kennedy assassination and indeed the late 60s in general spawned were the conspiracy mindedness, and my character doesn't like conspiracy mindedness, yet her tale is about an elaborate set of conspiracies of which she's only dimly aware.
Now, why did you make your first person narrator a woman? Not that you shouldn't have.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's my first novel as in the first person, and so that was the bigger shift for me. I wanted her, a couple of reasons. One, in the story, the fact that she is an 18-year-old in 1967 is not subject to the draft like her best friends. I was 14 at the time, and I... although I had a draft number and all that, I was just young enough never really to be vulnerable to being drafted. But so I wanted her to feel that, oh, I don't have any skin in this game. I'm not as vulnerable as my male friends, to be part of her radicalization process. Also, given that she's telling it from the near future, from now as a 64-year-old, 65-year-old woman, it seemed to me that how women's lives have changed over the last 45 years is much more interesting and consequential, really, than how men's lives have changed.
My guest is Kurt Anderson, whose latest book is called True Believers. It's published by Random House. The title is self-explanatory?
I think it's self-explanatory. Well, and the title, along with the cover art, which is a hand giving a peace symbol and then another hand crossing its fingers. Who was a true believer or not, and how idealisms were distorted by secret agendas, and how, you know, who can remain a true believer for their whole lives.
Well, you, as we point out, were 14 in 1968. Were you still engaged in all of this activity?
I was, as much as one could be as a 14-year-old
in
Omaha, Nebraska.
You had to get permission from your parents to march on Washington.
Actually, well, I couldn't have marched on Washington, and one of the great things about, I think, parents in the 1960s is it was much more do what you want, laissez-faire. And so, no, I helped set up a draft resistance thing in my high school, and I brought speakers. And so, yeah, definitely, as much as a 14-year-old kid in Omaha could be, I was part of it.
We learn in the introductory first chapter that Karen Hollander is removing herself from being considered for an appointment to the Supreme Court because, as she says, she once set out to commit a spectacular murder, and people died. This is a secret she's kept for over 40 years. And that's why she's writing this memoir. She suffers from type 1 diabetes, something you also have to deal with.
I got diagnosed.
Karen? Is this like Madame Bovary?
No, although she worries in the book about Madame Bovary and being over-invested in fictional characters. It's about the only significant thing that Karen and I share. I at age 33, got what is called juvenile diabetes. And so, and I'd never seen that, the experience of that, the mental interior experience of that be dealt with in fiction. So I thought, well, there's something that hasn't been done that I can write what I know.
Well, should we consider her a totally reliable narrator? She's talking about something that happened 44 years before.
She says and reminds the reader that she is a reliable narrator. I would say she's as reliable as a narrator can be, yet she doesn't know what she doesn't know, and she knows she doesn't know a lot. And a lot of the book is her trying to piece together the puzzle of what happened then and why she's been allowed to live this grand, successful life in the 45 years since.
It's interesting that Ian Fleming and James Bond play a role in this whole story. In her review of the novel for the New York Times, Francine Prose says it's largely about the influence literature can have on one's life.
It is. And again, I didn't start out writing a novel with that idea in mind. I started with this small idea of these kids at age 12 and 13 in the early 60s would read the James Bond books and become obsessed.
Is that something that happened with you?
No, I never read a James Bond book until I decided to write this novel. I'd seen all the movies, of course, but other books. Kurt Vonnegut I became obsessed with. I became obsessed with J.R.R. Tolkien as a 12-year-old, but not the Ian Fleming books. But then that led to this idea that the way that fiction, either literature or things in the television and movies, whatever, have, I think, in the last half century been a thing that affects the way people think of themselves and the things people do more than ever before.
It's not just books. Dylan protest songs,
absolutely.
The Grateful Dead, drug culture, speakers who inspired people to act.
No, the whole culture. Well, again,
Marcuse a rather abstract philosopher becoming a popular figure with the kids.
No, Herbert Marcuse, and again, can't help but figure with these educated students in college in 1967. No, exactly, this obscure German former CIA agent philosopher becomes this sort of superstar. It was. In lots of ways. I don't want to be one of those boring baby boomers who says, those were the days. But they were an amazing time that I don't think in my lifetime we'll see the likes of again.
You wrote Time Magazine's Person of the Year cover story in 2011, and it was awarded to The Protester. So I'm assuming this book is also pulling together a bunch of strands of things that you've been thinking about over the last few years.
Well, actually, in that case, the editor of Time Magazine called me up last fall as Arab Spring was playing out, as the Occupy movement was starting, and said, hey, are you interested in writing this piece? And I thought, whoa, this is an extraordinary bit of serendipity, because I had just finished this book, which is essentially, among other things, about 40 years of the ups and downs and of protest, yeah.
Well, the people wondered why protest was so much a part of the culture in the 60s and early 70s, and then pretty much died out, and why it suddenly pops up at another time.
I think it's funny. As I look at the long history of protests and revolution, it seems as though, and looking back more than 200 years, every half century, more or less, enough people get old or die off who were involved in the last one that a new generation of young people can say, we're angry, we don't like this, and aren't in their living memory what happened the last time isn't there to stop them.
In a recent episode of Studio 360, you mentioned that you had some legal issues, including lyrics in the book.
Yeah,
this is always a problem when you want to quote from things. You got to get permission, and sometimes people ask you for an awful lot of money.
Well, and in this case, for the two songs I recorded or I quoted at length, I paid the money. It was an interesting process. I knew about the issue in the abstract. It was really interesting to plunge in and say, okay, here's two songs, Be My Baby, and I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, that I really want to quote at length because they figure in the plot. And the process of finding all the rights holders and negotiating fees was an interesting learning experience.
Be My Baby, Phil Spector?
Yes, exactly.
He's in jail. Can't you just quote it without...
A, there are other rights holders. B, he still has an enormous revenue stream that is managed by various firms.
You also wanted to quote Bob Dylan lyrics.
Well, I Bob Dylan naturally comes up a lot, and I have the character say at one point, as she wants to quote Bob Dylan in her fictional memoir, this book, it would cost too much to quote Dylan at length.
One of the themes here is that many baby boomers get to live two very different kinds of lives. They were passionate revolutionaries when they were younger, and then they become successful professionals with comfortable family lives when they grow older. I'm assuming that was one of the key points you wanted to write about here.
Yeah, that to the degree I began with any kind of general idea beyond the specific story and the specific characters, it was that. I mean, to me, this generation is about having your cake and eating it too in so many cases and in so many ways and sort of getting away with murder, figuratively at least. So, yeah, absolutely.
And then their kids or even their grandkids sometimes want to go out and protest.
And they're
confused about that.
Well, my character Karen's granddaughter is the 17-year-old Occupy protester. Complains at a certain point, like, all the protests today just seem like cover versions of the 60s, Grandma.
Kurt Anderson is the author of the novels Heyday and Turn of the Century, among other books. He also writes for television, film, the stage, contributes to Vanity Fair, and hosts the PRI public radio program, Studio 360. His latest novel is True Believers. It's published by Random House. Thanks for being on our show again.
Thank you so much. And if people want to come to dinner, they may.